Cut Gems podcast. This is our Patreon exclusive Steven Soderbergh Shallow Cut episode for February 2023. My name is Randy.
And my name is Jakub.
And how are you doing, Jakub?
I'm doing well. Thanks very much. How are you doing, Randy? Are you happy to be here?
Good. Yeah, I'm very excited to be here. So we're getting into Soderbergh mode. So yeah, good to go. And it is just the two of us today. Nick was unable to join us, but we are going to do him proud with our discussion on our boy Soderbergh. So want to get right to it, but we'll just quickly spin through a couple little things that we have going on. So calendar is turning into February, so we are starting a new theme on our main show. We'll mention that. As the Oscar nominations just came out this week, we are sort of celebrating the spirit of film award season. So on the main show, Uncut Gems podcast, available everywhere where you get your fine quality podcasts, our February theme will be Oscar winning best pictures sequels. So, and
so not sequels to that won Oscars.
No.
Just to be clear.
Sequels to good movies.
Sequels to good movies.
Sequels to renowned movies, I guess. We'll put it that way. So that's our theme over on the main show. And tying into that theme.
It's a cross to bear.
But we'll do it. We'll do it for people. Here on Patreon, our tie-in will be In the Heat of the Night, the 1968 film, and that's going to connect into what we're doing on the main show with our theme. Also on Patreon, our new marathon series is well underway. In 2023, it is the year of the Cassavetes. So last month, we talked about John Cassavetes' first film, Shadows, and that was a great chat. You should check that out if you haven't already. Listen to poor Jakub trying desperately to convince all of us that Shadows is a masterpiece, but he did convince us to all like it, but he's in a league all by himself.
I'll take my victories where I can find them.
So following up this month later on our Patreon channel, we're going to be talking about John Cassavetes' second film, Too Late Blues. So big thank you to all of your subscribers. We really appreciate your support. So, and if you happen to stumble across us on our main feed, that's great. But heads up, you are going to be missing us at around the 15-minute mark as you will come to an abrupt halt. So check out our Patreon offerings over at www.patreon.com/uncutgemspod. All right. Without any further ado, we are here today to talk about Steven Soderbergh. This is the first Friday of each month in our main show. We're doing what we call a Steven Soderbergh deep cut, some of his lesser known films. And February's deep cut on the main show will be a double episode, a double bill of 1995's The Underneath and 1996's Schizopolis. But here on Patreon, and the reason we're here today is we are going to be doing our Steven Soderbergh Shallow Cut, where we dive into one of his more beloved films. And we're going to do our best. So Jakub put a lot of effort into our scheduling here, and we're going to do our best to try to keep things chronological. So today, in that spirit, we are going to be doing his third feature-length film, released in 1993, King of the Hill.
Hold on.
Going.
I have to leave a note for Lester.
Is there a law against knocking on his door?
He said it disturbs his mother.
Is she sick?
I don't know. I've never seen her.
Of course she's sick. She's got back trouble from bending over to pick up secret messages all day. Come on.
All right, King of the Hill, which was released in 1993, was directed by our guy, Steven Soderbergh. It was written by Soderbergh as well, and based on A.E. Hockner's memoir, it stars young actor Jesse Bradford as the protagonist, and also Yaron Krabbe and Lisa Eichorn as the main character's parents. And then you also have Karen Allen, Spalding Gray, Elizabeth McGovern, Adrian Brody, And a couple smaller, interesting people show up. Katherine Heigl in a small role, and Lauren Hill from the Fugees, I believe, shows up in a small role as well. And yeah, this is a story. It's a coming of age story. And, you know, from the new vocabulary department, I learned this is a Bildungsroman. I think I said that. Okay.
Bildungsroman. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and as a coincidence, as you learn these new terms, my wife is talking about Bildungsroman the other day at the table, which was interesting. So I felt semi-smart because I had stumbled across this term just in time.
Do you guys live in like a Woody Allen film where it's just like a bunch of intellectuals just talking about literature over dinner?
No, just my wife. But I was there to catch up to her. It was great because I stumbled across this term, Bildungsroman. Basically, it's a coming-of-age story, and it's set in the Great Depression in St. Louis, Missouri, and it's the story of Aaron. It's a memoir, as I say. It's A.E. Hockner's memoir, so Aaron is young Hockner, and that's played, this role of Aaron is played by young actor Jesse Bradford. He lives with his family on the third floor of the Empire Hotel, which is a place, I guess, where at the time, several families in transition, there are sort of in between homes or in between jobs or just their life is in flux. They live on this third floor.
Great Depression, right?
As well. It's during the Great Depression. And slowly, as life gets harder during the 1930s, people start disappearing from Aaron's life. Not in like a horror type of way, but people slowly drift away from him. Neighbors are locked out of their rooms by hotel management. His younger brother is sent away. His mom gets sick and has to leave to, you know, be in care. And his dad has to leave and make money as a salesman on the road. And that leaves poor Aaron more and more alone and needing to find a way to survive. So slowly, the innocence of youthful play is replaced by the harsh reality of fending for yourself culture. So Aaron finds himself navigating the difficulties of an adult world, in essence, all by his lonesome. Behind the scenes, as I mentioned, this is Soderbergh's third film. After working in Europe for his second film, Kafka, he comes back and he finds this new project and he comes across Hockner's memoir, King of the Hill. I'm not sure exactly, maybe we'll get into this, how this opportunity came along, if he pursued it or if he was in fact solicited. But Hockner himself was a successful writer and he was actually good friends with Ernest Hemingway. He wrote Hemingway's biography, Papa Hemingway, and Hockner's a bit of a character in his own right too. So he wrote a lot of stage plays and teleplays and several adaptions of Hemingway's work for the stage and for TV and film. He was also really good friends with one Paul Newman, and Paul Newman said, "You should take that memoir you wrote and turn it into a screenplay." But Hockner said, "No, this is too hard. It's too difficult to go through these memories. I don't think I could do that." So Soderbergh, he comes into the picture and he writes this memoir.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
He says,
"Pick me." So he does this with Wildwood Enterprises, which is Robert Redford's production company, and Bonafide Productions. They raise $8 million in production capital. And so it's still an indie-sized type of production, but still decent size, just the same. And that's most of what I have in terms of details. Now, in terms of the making of this, other possible, I'll just mention a little bit of industry background as well. In the early 1990s, this is a time where a lot of indie projects were popping up, and independent film production companies like Miramax and New Line and Gramercy, they were starting to become very successful off of small budget, high return films. And a lot of this goes back to Sex, Lies, and Videotapes, actually. The independent film scene is sort of coming alive courtesy of Redford's Sundance Film Festival, which is a festival that was sort of rebranded as Sundance in the early 90s. So studios are beginning to restructure their annual film lineups into three tiers: blockbusters, medium-sized releases, and art house releases. Studios are acquiring subsidiaries to specialize in art films. So you got production houses popping up all over the place. So you get more small budget films that are being greenlit without necessarily having any big marketing campaigns to go along with them. And honestly, so The reason I mention this is because King of the Hill seems to be one of these projects that there's a bit of an appetite to make these small budget films, but they're basically low risk, and a lot of them are being dumped on the market without a lot of marketing support. That seems to be the case here, because King of the Hill is truly an art house release. It's very small North American release, not much marketing attached to it. And it's only released on a handful of screens and musters $1.2 million in receipts in North America. Not much. And I have no real worldwide or numbers on this, but this seems like the type of film that probably wouldn't play well worldwide, just sort of a historic American drama. They tend to have very minimal releases overseas. This also went on to have a very small release on video. Probably didn't make too much money there either. But these art films, they were appealing. And one of the ideas was if they lost money, it wasn't too much money that they lost. So the critics liked it, but they didn't seem to be yelling from the rooftops over it. It was, you know, generally well received. Ebert loved it. Janet Maslin loved it. I think it was one of the top 5-10 reviewed films of the year. Aggregate review sites, so Rotten Tomatoes, Letterboxd, strong numbers for it there. However, it's a hard to find, seldom discussed title even today. But to Soderbergh fans, it's often considered a hidden treasure. So, Jakob, tell me, what is your history with this film?
I don't have any history of it. That was my first time.
Okay.
That was my first time with King of the Hill. And I don't know whether I should break your heart now or should I wait. I'm going to break your heart now. This ain't very good, Chief.
Wow.
I have to qualify this statement.
Yeah.
Because I've been thinking about this film more and more, and this is a film that's expertly made. It's this. I watched this, and my notes are almost exclusive, apart from just a few funny scenes that will make an appearance on my bottom three list. they're almost all related to craft, to direction, to framing, to production design, because this you could feel the $8 million in there. You can see that there's like when I didn't really want to go and contradict you immediately and say like, well, $8 million in 1993 is quite a lot of money. And just like Reservoir Dogs was made for like 1.1 or something like this, right? And probably half of it was Harvey Keitel's cut, and then the other half was renting the warehouse, right? But
I think anything around 10 or less around this time is probably in the independent side of things, right?
I mean, for me, this sits. I mean, this sits kind of like in this sort of mid range almost. Now it would be this sort of not now, like because they don't exist anymore. But say like 10 years ago, this would have been this sort of the $30 to $50 million movie that Fox or Focus Features or Fox Searchlight will make, with the explicit assumption that they're losing money on this, and this is gonna, and they're gonna get, and they're gonna allow, I don't know, Martin Scorsese to blow $50 million on this, right? Or David Fincher, because this is never gonna sell tickets. And it is, for me, this is like a Silver Fox film. Like, you know, this film is designed to endear the grannies in the audience. Like, that's kind of, I mean, I know, like, from now on, because I know the phrase Bildungsroman, and this is just a fancier way of saying a coming of age story, but I'm going to adopt it from now on to get it sounds a little bit snooty. but as far as the story goes, I would say like, the expertly made film that I really enjoy looking at the craft of, but it's a story that could have just not have been told, and the world would have just moved on. And then at some point, like when like Paul Newman was saying, like, you should make a movie out of your memoirs, and like you should have listened to your gut, you know, Mr. Author, can't remember your name. He's like, oh no, I shouldn't. Exactly, because not much happens in there. Like, you know. So the way I see it, you can if you tell stories, you can either, you can do it one of two ways. You either have, if we subscribe to the right what you know sort of scenario, either you have a great life experience and you base it around the fact that you have an amazing.
If you'd like to listen to this show in its entirety, head over to our Patreon over at patreon.com/uncutgemspod, where for $3 a month you'll be able to hear many other bonus recordings of ours, such as tie-ins to our main show, mini retrospectives, and comprehensive director marathons. patreon.com/uncutgemspod is the place, so head over there and subscribe.